gonna rock these shades, gonna scream my name, make you shout now, honey, gonna make you shout.
Whether you're an independent artist or a fan that loves them, makingascene.org is the place for you. For the music fan, we bring you in-depth interviews and CD reviews from artists who are on the cutting edge of original music. For the independent artist, we bring you articles on music business, recording techniques, gear reviews, and interviews with industry professionals that give you real-world information to help you negotiate the new realities in the music industry and give you the tools you need to move your career to the next level. We bring you new content every day. MakingAScene.org is the number one resource for the independent artists and the fans that love them. Head on over and become part of the indie revolution.
Gonna scream my name, make you shout now, honey, gonna make you shout, make you shout, make you shout.
And now, here's an indie blues double shot from our featured artist today, the Mighty Soul Drivers. And stay tuned for that interview. It comes up right after these songs.
She won't give me no love. Thought I'd get that satisfaction with a part-time love. Jumping right into a passing flame, put my love on the line, risking everything. And here I sit in the parking lot. As you touch me that way, oh yeah, thought it was cool. We were both so ready to play, but there's no fool like an old fool. I just didn't know enough to keep my cool. Here I too long. I can't help myself. old Route 6.
Soul Drivers from their brand new release, and we got River City Slim on the line right now. Hey, River City, how you doing?
I'm good. And yourself?
I'm doing pretty well. Now, this is the first time you've been on our show, and we always like to give our fans an opportunity to get to know who you are. And the best way to do that is through your journey, how you got to where you are today. So give us the story of River City Slim and of the Mighty Soul Drivers.
Well, I started out listening to music when I was really young by listening to old 10-inch LPs that my father had. My two favorites were by Bunk Johnson, a New Orleans jazz guy, and Hank Williams. He had a 10-inch LP called Moanin' the Blues that I used to listen to when I was really small. of course, as I got older, I started playing music when I was in elementary school, joined the school band, etc. And as a teenager, I decided I wanted to play, rock and roll music, etc., because I got my first radio, and that turned me on to a whole world of music. When I got my own radio, I suddenly realized that there was this whole universe of music that I had never heard before, and I've been obsessed with music ever since. So I was, trying to learn to play. I dabbled with guitars. I really wanted to play drums, but my parents didn't want any drums in the house. So I dabbled with guitars and other things, and eventually started playing drums when I got my first apartment and I was able to have drums. And I've been playing music ever since. In the 70s, I lived in Willimantic, Connecticut, which was the home of the Shabu, which was a nightclub conveniently situated between New York and Boston that attracted a lot of the touring musicians of the day as a convenient stop between those two places. And it was mostly blues guys at first. It was all of the blues people that were still alive in the 70s, still alive and performing, played at the Shabu. I saw B.B. King, Albert King, Freddie King, Muddy Waters, John Lee Hooker, James Cotton, and on and on and on. I was totally into that. So by the end of the 70s, I wasn't listening to rock music at all anymore. I was totally into blues, and I played in blues bands, a variety of them. I played harmonica and sang in one. I played drums in others. I also got into Cajun and Zydeco music in the late 80s originally, and into the 90s. And I started playing some of that. I played in a Cajun band for a while and started my own Zydeco band here in New England, trying, of course, to be as close to the Louisiana style as possible. And I had always been a big fan of Southern soul music. I mean, that was a big component of the blues that I listened to, but I never thought I was going to be able to play it. I didn't think I was, you know, it requires a certain level of ability to play it right. It's not as easy as playing like some simple rock and roll or simple blues. And I had been rehearsing with some horn players who were, they were good players, but I'm like, okay, we can play some R&B now. And they just wanted to play like Chicago covers. And I didn't want to play Saturday in the Park or anything like that. That just wasn't my thing. So that got me started thinking. I said, well, maybe I'm going to try to do this. Forget about these guys. I'm going to try to start something else. Because in that situation, I wasn't leading that group. I was just part of it. Most of the bands that I'm in, I end up being the leader because I have definite ideas of what we should be doing and how we should be doing it. And if I end up at odds with somebody, well, I'll leave the band and start another one. But I've been successful in the sense that I've always been able to attract other musicians that see that I'm able to make things happen. I can get gigs for people and put together something that's musically interesting, and we can actually work a little bit too, and people can make a little money. So I put together the Mighty Soul Drivers. I had been thinking about it for a while and had a couple of false starts, and then I ran into Bob Orsi, who is our lead singer. I ran into him at a jam session run by the Connecticut Blues Society. And he is, I've known him for years. He's one of the best singers in Connecticut. And I had played with him, never actually been in the same band, but we played together at jam sessions, et cetera. I would sit in with one of his bands or stuff like that. So I said to him at the jam, I said, look, I've been trying to put together a Memphis-style soul band. Would you like to be the singer? And his immediate response was, no, I'm too busy. But before this jam session was over, he came back to me and said, give me a call. I think I'd like to try it. And after that, it was easy. Once Bob was on board, it was easy to get other musicians to be interested because people wanted to play with Bob because he's a good singer. And I got a guitar player, Larry Willie, who another guy that I've known for years and played with at jams and sat in with his bands and all that kind of stuff, but we'd never actually been in a band together all the time. He had been mostly a band leader. He was tired of leading his own bands because of all the headaches that can come along with being a band leader. Some people think it's glamorous, but you know, it's really a lot of work. The band leader has to do way more work than the rest of the people in the band do in order to make it successful. And Larry was tired of that, and so he was happy to come on and just be a soldier, which was great. Now we had the core of the band, myself, Bob, and Larry. I got a keyboard player and a bass player, and we started rehearsing. We made our first public appearance at the Connecticut Blues Society's Blues Challenge, where the winner of the Blues Challenge goes to the IBC in Memphis. And we didn't even have enough material ready to play for an hour, right? But at the Blues Challenge, you only have to play for 25 minutes because that's what they do at the IBC.
Right.
So we went in there. We went in there with our 25-minute set, and we won the preliminary. We were shocked, right? So so we were off to a good start. It's like, okay, we got something here. And we didn't win the finals that year, but we came back 2 years later and won the finals and eventually went to Memphis. By that time, the rest of the, some of the other members of the band had changed out. I got a different keyboard player. We had a sax player for a while, and then I got a different sax player who's the guy that we have now. And the keyboard player that came in is still with us. And, of course, we still have myself, Bob, and Larry, where we started. And eventually we added a full-time trumpet player. For a little while, we were using a trumpet sub that would play some shows. If we were on a big enough stage and making enough money, we would add the trumpet. But he wasn't really on the bus, so it didn't... because he was just a hired gun, so he didn't really learn the material as well as he might have if he was a regular member, et cetera. You know, there was an upside and a downside to it. Eventually, I found another guy who wanted to be in the band, wanted to be on the bus, and he's been with us ever since. Okay. And we've made two recordings in the 10 years that the band has been in existence, the second of which is the brand new one that was just released last month.
Well, let's talk about that new release. What was your goal for this? What were you looking to achieve with this particular release?
Respect. Okay. I'll put it in one word, respect. Because in this day and age, to make money on a recording, the chances of that happening are really slim. The music marketing business has changed so much in such a short time that the idea of making a recording and making money at it, if that's what you think you're going to do, you're probably going to be unpleasantly surprised. So we decided up front, we weren't going to be concerned about the money aspect of it. We weren't going to try to cut any corners, trying to save money on the production or anything else. We're all guys that have been playing music for years. Let's go in there and do the absolute best thing that we can possibly do and not worry about the economics of it and let that all sort out after. So the main thing is like to get some respect, because right off people say, a Memphis soul band from Connecticut. when I was in Memphis at the IBC, a lot of people down there sort of chuckle when you say you're from New England. They think, how could a blues or a soul band be from New England? But so it's about respect, being known for being a band that's fully developed and has something to offer beyond beyond just being a dance band at your local tavern.
Okay. Now, let's talk about you as a songwriter, because, you know, every good release begins with a good song. When you sit down to begin that process, what is your mechanism that you use to kind of get the muse going?
Usually I have a line or even a phrase, something that I've heard either somebody saying or a piece of somebody else's song somewhere. Some line that I'll write it down and maybe not come back to it for a long time, but I have a couple of notebooks that I keep some junk in, and the best songs that I've written were actually I didn't really write them. They just came to me without me even having to think that much about it. I've heard other people say the same thing, that you wake up in the morning and all of a sudden there it is. You just sit down and you just write it all out and it's there. It just happened, rather than struggling over it, trying to craft every line. Maybe you go back and you edit it, you know, make some changes to make it a little bit smoother. But the best ones, the most successful ones, are ones that just like came out whole, pretty much.
Okay. There's, now, you know, I always find lyrics and melody to be kind of two different processes as writers. You know, lyrics being very structured in the fact that you have to have a story, some continuity, rhyme, meter. And melody's a little different. Some songwriters like to work off that groove. Others like to have a chord structure to kind of, you know, constrain that melody. And then others take the lyric and find the melody within its cadence. When you start looking for the melodic aspects of your, you know, when you write, what is your go-to when you start looking for melody?
That's hard to say. I almost always write the lyrics first, right? That's because I'm a drummer. I mean, I also play harmonica and sing, but I don't have a chordal instrument that I can play while I'm trying to write a song. So usually I'll write lyrics and maybe try to fit them to some existing song that I hear to see how, just to see if I can sing them, if they fit certain chord structures. And then if I have something that's even halfway there, I'll bring it to one of the other band members and that has a guitar or a piano and see if we can figure out what the right chords would be. And I'm not going to sing it anyways, because Bob is our singer, and he's the one that's going to have to phrase it and sing it. So even though it may be my name on the song, there were other people that helped it along. A good example is Parking Lot Blues on the new CD. Now, I wrote that song, I don't know, 5 years ago probably initially, and it went through many iterations. I brought it to the band multiple times. We hashed out an arrangement. We actually played it live a few times, but it was never quite right. It just really didn't work right. I didn't have it yet, and the rest of nobody else in the band could come up with something that made it work either. So it just got put on the shelf until it was time to make this recording, and it was like, okay, we need original material. Let's pull this back out. And we were fooling around with it again, and the keyboard player made a suggestion. He said, let's just try a whole different feel. Let's see if we can play it as if Al Green was singing it. That's what he said. He said, let's think about it as if Al Green was singing it. And so immediately, that's like most people would understand what that feel is. You're thinking of, you know, that the high record sound, sort of mid-tempo, chugging sound to it, with, you know, with vocals, you know how Al Green was like soaring, kind of a soaring, swooping mm-hmm. singer. So we just. That one suggestion changed everything. All of a sudden, it's like, whoa, I think we got something here.
All right.
And that's the way it worked. And then once we tried that feel, and then so once the feel, whole feel of the song is different, that changed the horn arrangement that had already been written for it. Not a lot, but he had to rewrite it to fit the new feel, which made it even better. I mean, I was really pleased with the way that turned out, considering that the song had been kicking around for a few years and we just couldn't make it work.
All right. Now, every songwriter also gets to that point where they have to put that pen down and they have to give the song to the band, they have to give the song to the producer. How do you determine when a song is ready to bring into the studio and begin that process of putting it together with the band?
That's a good question. You just heard my story of how that one evolved.
Right.
That's that's pretty much how I do it. I have to have something that's lyrically pretty close to finished. I was recently rereading the Keith Richards book. What's it called? Life. And he was talking about the way he writes songs with Mick Jagger. And Keith would say, because Keith starts out by playing the guitar, of course, right?
Right.
And usually has a couple of words, if that. Sometimes they're just grunting. He's just grunting, you know, some notes, and plays it like that for Mick. And then Mick goes off and writes some lyrics, right? Which is like totally different than what I'm doing. It's the exact opposite. So it's before I try to show it to anybody else, I expect to have something that's lyrically reasonably coherent, not just like Keith Richards, a few grunts and a few notes, and then his partner runs off and writes some lyrics. I want to have those lyrics pretty much, you know, they may change depending on how we fit music to it, but the idea has to be complete before I'm showing it to anybody.
Okay. Now, let's talk about going into the studio, because having a good song is half the process. Going into the studio not only creates the identity of that song, but also it helps to create the identity of you as an artist, the band, as a cohesive unit. And every artist has their way of working in that environment to get that sound that identifies them. When you get in that environment of the studio, how do you like to work to capture the sound you're looking for?
Well, every recording I've ever made, I've made two albums with the Mighty Soul Drivers. I made a few with my Zydeco band. I made some recordings with a blues band back in the 90s. Every single one of those recordings started out with the entire band in the studio playing live.
Okay.
Now you set up some separation so that you can manipulate tracks after. For instance, you know, a guitar amps are in a in an isolation booth, and the singer is in an isolation booth, so that you can swap out those tracks because there's nothing else, like the drums didn't bleed into those mics, but the whole band is there playing live to start.
Right. Right.
I personally can't understand how people can go in there and assemble a cohesive song one track at a time. That's got to be really hard. in order to make it feel natural, right? In fact, there was one track that we recorded for our first album where the bass player couldn't make it that night. So we went ahead and recorded the basic track with the keyboard player playing a bass line. Probably nobody else can tell, but every time I hear that, I go, we should have done that over, because the bass part that was added afterwards doesn't feel the same as if the drummer and the bass player were playing together at the same time. To me, anyways, I can hear the difference. So that to me tells me when I hear a record that I know was assembled by the bass and drums were not playing at the same time, and I hear something that sounds like a cohesive groove, I go, how did they do that? I know I can't do that. I like the whole band has to be there, and we play the song, and like I said, certain tracks are isolated so that you can change them out afterwards if need be, or edit them, do whatever needs to be done. For instance, most of the lead vocals are discarded, right? And the lead vocals are done over. But there's at least one track that where we did not discard the lead vocals. The lead vocal that was done in the original with the original live basic track was good enough, and we kept it. You know, most of the time, I don't think too many people record live with the lead vocals live. It's probably almost always, you know, the singer is isolated so that they can come back and sing over a completed track. Right, but certainly everybody being in the same room playing together makes for a different feel.
Oh yeah, without a doubt. You know, I've been a recording engineer since 1980, and you know, over my years of working in studios and my own studio, I mean, it's always best to capture a performance as opposed to perfection. You know what I mean?
Right. And you can always fix, especially with, you know, everything's digital now. It's really easy to fix small things in the performance. You know, somebody hits a wrong note there, or you know.
Oh yeah, I mean, Melodyne. You can
the singer missed his note. He can do it over, right?
Oh yeah. Now, tell me about the lineup on this. Who's playing on it?
Okay, so we have the three people that started the band originally: myself on drums, Bob Orsi on lead vocals, and rhythm guitar on some tracks. Larry Willey is the guitar player. So we were the three original members. And then we have Steve Donovan on keyboards, John Smeda on saxophones, Tony DeLicio on the bass, and Neil Tint on trumpet and flugelhorn.
Okay. Now, of course, once you get something recorded, you have to get it out there. You have to create a buzz. You have to get it to radio. And you're working with Betsy Brown from Blind Raccoon to do your radio and PR. Tell me a little bit about that relationship.
She's doing a fantastic job for us. We're getting recognition. I wouldn't even be talking to you if it wasn't for her, because you probably wouldn't know about this record. Because when we recorded the first one 8 years ago, which by the way is still available, and it stands on its own. I listened to that today, and I still say, you know, we did a good job on that. I think our new one is better because we did. The band had evolved some, and we were in a better studio. There's some slight changes, but that first one's still stands today as a good recording, but we didn't have a radio or a publicity person back then, and I tried to do it all myself, and of course it didn't get much notice because I don't have the network to get the word out, or even if I am getting the word out, people don't pay attention because you're not somebody they know, right? When people get publicity notices from Blind Raccoon, they pay attention because they know that Blind Raccoon represents all these other great artists. And when they're getting a note, you know, some information from Blind Raccoon, it's going to be good stuff. You know, Betsy isn't out there promoting guys that aren't any good, right? So that made a big difference. We've received a lot more notice as a result. Early on, the album was just released. The week that the album was released, we had a review in No Depression magazine, which really surprised me, because it's not Life magazine or People magazine, but it's still in the music world. That's a pretty sizable publication with a wide scope. For them to notice our little record, I thought was pretty incredible. And they really liked it. They gave us a really nice review, and they included the title track on their Best of the Month playlist. So it was putting our music in front of a lot of people that wouldn't ordinarily know about it.
Okay.
And that's as a result of the work that Blind Raccoon did for us.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Betsy's definitely good at what she does. Now, let's talk about the music industry. You know, coming out of the pandemic, you know, touring is starting to open up again. But if there are some major challenges, you know, one being the digital revolution, the consumer no longer looks at recorded music as a product anymore. There's touring issues because of the pandemic. A lot of venues had shut down or stopped bringing in touring acts. What are some of the biggest challenges that you're seeing right now as an independent artist that is kind of getting in your way, or you're finding as an issue as you move forward?
Well, I have to say that this latest album is certainly the best work I've ever done, but I'm not selling that many of them, which is not surprising. I didn't expect to, but the way to sell them is that at live shows, people see your show, they like it, they'll buy the CD. But expecting to sell them online is, you know, you're not going to sell very many because it's out there for quote free unquote on loads of streaming platforms, etc., none of which pay very much money. I have other recordings that I've made in the past years back that were not of the quality of this new recording that actually I made money on. they were not as good, but the market was different, and I was actually able to make money selling the recordings. So today, this is not just for independent artists. It's for big artists too. It used to be tours were to support an album, right? The people went out to tour to support their album sales. Now it's the other way around. You record an album to support your tour because the real money is being made at the live shows.
Right.
And if you can't book the band into, decent rooms with that pay decent, it's very tough to make any money because you're certainly not going to make it from selling the recordings. For now, we'll have to say those days are in the past. It could change. No, who knows? We don't know what it's going to be like 5 or 10 years from now. Well, any more than 10 years ago, we could have predicted we would have been in where we are now.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting because the digital revolution, you know, the consumer really has embraced streaming. The problem is that if you look at these streaming platforms, the bulk of their content really comes from the independent artist. I mean, all right, maybe their major generating monies artists are the big ones on the major labels, you know, your Taylor Swift's and Beyonce and so on and so forth. But the bulk of the content still comes from the independent artist community. And you cannot continue to pay or to have a revenue stream where the artist can really, it's almost impossible to break even, you know, on that content. That's not a sustainable business plan. We need to have something that allows artists to at least have the potential to break even with a proper amount of revenue coming in. Do you think that there is a way that we can restructure these streaming platforms in order to create a better revenue stream for artists?
That's a good question, but it makes me think of this is just the 21st century version of the way the music business operated before the Beatles broke it wide open. I mean, think about it. Before the Beatles, everything was controlled by corporations, however small they were. The artists had very little say in what was going to happen with the music, and they got very little money. At every opportunity, the people that owned the companies that recorded and distributed the music took advantage of artists relentlessly. Things changed slightly when the Beatles came along, and the idea of the self-contained band that created their own music and played their own music, that suddenly became the norm, and there was more control shifted to the artist. However, there was still, you know, all you have to do is look on your bookshelf of music stories, and you're going to find plenty of artists, even hugely successful ones, that were victims of the system and didn't really get what they should have. I mean, you can look at somebody as big as John Fogerty, for instance. He signed one really bad contract when he was young and hungry, and he paid for it for a long, long, long time. Right now, here's a guy that wrote all these, you know, has a classic songbook that should rates up there with anybody. But he doesn't own any of it. So that the whole idea of companies taking advantage of the artist is not new. We just have a different way of doing it. So Spotify and whatever, YouTube, are making money the same way that back in the day it was record company executives made the money. And in fact, they used to put their name on the writer's credit because the publishing was important. That was where the real money was in the publishing, right? So you see all these classic songs that have some name in there that had nothing to do with the creation of the song. They were just there to share in the money, and they wouldn't put your record out unless you allowed them to put their name on your song, so that they got a share of the publishing. I mean, that's that's been happening ever since there was recorded music. So is there a way to make it more equitable? I'm sure there is, but will it happen? Artists have proven to be relatively powerless in the past. I don't know if that's ever going to change.
Well, you know, I've been following some interesting technology lately. One of the biggest things that's happening in the music industry, or one of the new buzzwords, is decentralizing the music industry. Much like cryptocurrency is a decentralized economic system, where no one company, country, or organization can control cryptocurrency, they utilize this technology called the blockchain, which is how they secure it. And this blockchain has the ability to embed applications within it. And one of the things that I've noticed is that there are streaming services that are being created utilizing this blockchain, which kind of freezes out any one corporation from owning it. It's more of a direct relationship between the fan and the artist, and they're claiming that they can pay the artist up to 80% of the incoming revenue that will come back to the content creators themselves. And it promises to have a whole bunch of other far-reaching ramifications when you start looking into this world of NFTs, you know, the non-fungible tokens, things like that. So this new technology is starting to take hold. One of these platforms is called Audius, which has the backing of like Katy Perry and Jason Derulo and a bunch of EDM and rap artists. And then, of course, there's Emanate. So this may be the natural evolution of streaming. And if you look at the digital revolution, it is really predicated on this constant changing of technology. We started out with Napster, with file sharing, and then we went to iTunes with, you know, the 99-cent downloads, and everyone said, oh, we'll never get rid of Apple. Apple will be here forever. You know, and well, it's not. It was replaced by Spotify, this little company out of Sweden. You know, now everyone says, oh, we'll never get rid of Spotify. Well, I don't see that as being a trend that really exists, because the trend is that when something new comes along that's a little bit better, a little bit different, a little bit more, you know, correct, whatever, the public, you know, gravitates to this new platform. So do you think that this could be a possible future for the industry?
Well, I'll tell you what. You're comparing this to the cryptocurrency, right? Have you read in the paper recently about what's happening in the crypto world?
Oh, yeah. Crypto's in the tanks.
First of all, right. First of all, the idea of the crypto being a peer-to-peer technology sort of went out the window along the way. And it was supposed to the whole idea was it was going to replace the central banking system, right? Because right now, our regular money, you have to have this banking or financial system that people trust as the guarantor of transactions, right, of real money. So we were going to replace all that because it was now going to be peer-to-peer using the blockchain and cryptocurrency. However, what happened was that there was no trust being built in peer-to-peer, and it ended up there were companies created that resembled the banks that supposedly were going to go away. And now those companies have failed, right? And if people, anybody that invested in those companies a year or two ago, when it was, or maybe it was a couple more years, whatever, they lost a lot of money. I think it was just today I was reading in the paper, the New York Times, that they lost like 70% of their value in a very short time. So, depending on the technology to make it more equitable, I don't know if that's really going to happen, but the possibilities are endless. The possibilities are endless. I'm just saying that the example, like for instance, you threw up crypto as an example. I'm going, well, that didn't work out too well for most people.
Yeah, but you know, it's
so
maybe
you have to think about it. They have to be, because it comes down to a level of trust, right? In saying, well, if I give you this, will you give me that? Will this really work? Which is what, for instance, banks have always done, or record companies, because artists years ago could not possibly create their own record. It was impossible. Now it's digital technology has made it easy for people to make recordings. Doesn't mean that they have good music. It just means it's easy for them to make a recording. That comes into play too, because the record companies used to serve as gatekeepers. Right. You had to be pretty good to get signed to a record company. Otherwise, you weren't going to make a record. Today, anybody that's got, a home studio, or say they have a couple thousand dollars, they can go to a real studio and make a recording. That doesn't mean it's going to be any good. They may have absolutely nothing to say. They may have no talent, no skills, whatever, but they can still make a recording, which maybe you probably see this. I've been a radio host for almost 30 years now, and there are so many new releases from so many people, it's almost impossible to sort through them all because of the revolution in recording technology.
Mm-hmm.
So that plays into the idea that a company like Spotify doesn't have to be worried about paying the artists that much, because there's so many people out there that can't wait to get their recording on Spotify. Even though, when you think about it, Spotify isn't even a good platform, because not only do they not pay the artists very well, they don't even have hi-fi. It doesn't even sound that good compared to, like, if you have the actual CD and you play it, listen to it, compare it to Spotify, Spotify's not hi-fi. So but then again, we got all these people listening on their phones, using earbuds, whatever. The idea of hi-fi has actually taken a back seat in a lot of ways, too.
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
the whole idea...
Think about it.
Go ahead.
I was thinking about it. We made all these advances in terms of recording quality and sound quality and... From the 50s into the 60s into the 70s and the 80s, everything was like getting better, 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 better. And then all of a sudden we hit the late 90s and MP3s and all this stuff, and the idea of hi-fi is sort of going out the window.
Well, yeah, and I agree with that 100%. Even, you know, the young kids today that are, touting vinyl as, this retro thing that they do, you know, they're still putting it on these cheap little turntables with USB outs and listening to them on earbuds. You know, it's, they don't understand the whole idea of audiophile. You know, when, back in the day, I remember going to, Crazy Eddie's or Sam Goody's or whatever, and financing speakers because they were that weak link in the chain that had to be, really, good. You know what I mean?
Right, but also from a recording perspective, as someone who's made multiple recordings, we're sitting in a studio listening to the best equipment that the studio owner was able to buy and put together to listen to our recording. But the true test is when you take that recording and go listen to it in your car, because that's where most people are going to hear it, right? I'm told that back in the day, they would bring their acetates to a radio station, have a DJ play the acetate, and they'd sit in their car and listen to it on the radio to hear how it really sounded. What was it going to sound like? And we're still doing the same thing today, in the sense that I take a digital file and plug it into my car radio and listen to it as I'm driving. I'm driving home from the studio. I'm listening to what we just recorded. It's going to sound a lot different than it did when we were actually in the studio listening to all, super high quality speakers, etc. And again, the end consumer may be listening to it on devices that are even lower fidelity. Who knows? So, I don't know. Technology has always played a part in art, right from day one. I mean, we've come a long way from people scraping rocks on rock walls in caves to try to create some kind of art to what we do today. And it's all been aided by technology. And artists are frequently in the forefront of technology adopters. But it's almost always co-opted by business at some point.
Right. Well, I really appreciate you coming on the show and talking with us. And we're going to give everyone out there a double shot from your new release. You guys are going to love this. You know what? Turn it up loud. Screw the neighbors. We're going to have some fun today. Get through the night.
kill. Well, now,
in the middle of the night.
your way.
Whether you're an independent artist or a fan that loves them, makingascene.org is the place for you. For the music fan, we bring you in-depth interviews and CD reviews from artists who are on the cutting edge of original music. For the independent artist, we bring you articles on music business, recording techniques, gear reviews, and interviews with industry professionals that give you real-world information to help you negotiate the new realities in the music industry and give you the tools you need to move your career to the next level. We bring you new content every day. MakingAScene.org is the number one resource for the independent artists and the fans that love them. Head on over and become part of the indie revolution.
Gonna rock these shades. Gonna scream my name. Make you shout now, honey.